I found that Beyond Today to be interesting. I didn't know what was coming up either, but I've been involved with research in brain neurochemistry and related over the years, and it's kind of gory, I guess, but I've removed brains from dogs, horses, cats, birds, dolphin, all kinds of animals. And I know taking the brain out of a dolphin, I said, man, this is a complex brain, and it struck me that it's so similar to a human brain, and there's so much difference, though, in the mind of a human. And I know with the neurochemical aspect that our minds are remarkably active when we don't really know it. What's going on in the background? You've probably experienced that when you're trying to remember someone's name and you just can't remember it, and you go on to something else and it pops in your mind because your mind's still working on it. Or sometimes, even when you're asleep, you're kind of trying to solve a problem and it goes away and you wake up the next morning and you say, I've got the answer to that. There's a lot going on in the background in our minds, and with a near-death experience, I think it's the same thing. Our minds can be quite active, and a lot can be happening there. So their bottom line was we have to go to the Bible for the answer is the true one and the right one. It relates to what I want to talk about today as well. And what I'm doing today is a little different, but I think a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, looking on CNN, there was a story about some new humanoid skulls that had been found, and they were talking about how this would redefine the way we looked at human evolution. And it's confusing. It's confusing to a lot of people. This evolution is a very powerful tool of Satan. We don't need God with evolution, really. That's what makes it so strong. It's kind of a religion of its own right. So today I wanted to talk about evolution. And I hope it's enlightening, and I hope not too confusing. It confused me a little bit, but I tried to keep it simple. It goes back really to before we moved here. We lived in the mountains of Virginia, in Blacksburg, Virginia, when I worked there. And nearest big city was Roanoke, Virginia. It's a beautiful area. And that's where United was, and we would drive about 50 miles up I-81 every Sabbath and attend church there. I got my newspaper from Roanoke as the biggest city, and the January 1, 2006 Roanoke Times published a letter to the editor. They've been bantering back and forth in these letters, and I kind of watched that. It was interesting to me. It was about evolution versus creationist attitudes or beliefs. And this particular letter that was sent into the Roanoke Times was entitled "Creationist Posing as Rationalists," and it kind of caught my eye. It, I think, says something about us as creationists. Are we not rational people? Is it not a rational platform? Is it not something that we can support and defend? The title to me also suggests that a creationist view is just not rationally defendable, and a lot of people feel this way. The title was further consistent with an idea often presented to the public that virtually all educated people, including all reputable scientists, support the theory of evolution over intelligent design. And I think that's my experience. That's what I find. Sometimes you're frowned upon as maybe ignorant if you don't believe in evolution. I recall when I was in college, I think this was probably about 1977. It was a while ago. And I took a course called Comparative Anatomy, and it was a hard course. It was really a tough one. It compared the anatomy of all the domestic and non-domestic species and their development, and it was heavily based in evolution. The reason it was a hard course primarily is it was an eliminator course for pre-med students, all those who wanted to go to med school and had to have A's. So they studied very hard, and they shifted the curve in that course. So when we came in that first day, we were all pretty serious. We knew what we were facing. And an old gentleman walked in. He was retirement age, the individual who taught that course, and he was wearing a coat and tie, and he taught that way every day when he came in. And he walked in, and he came to the front, and he kind of looked at all of us, and we were looking back. It's like he was sizing us up. And then in this demeanor of total control, and I'm totally sure of myself and who I am, and comfortable, he turned and he reached behind himself to his desk, and he picked up a book and swung it forward so that we could all see what it was. And it was a Bible. And Dr., I won't give his name, he opened the book to Genesis 1. You might do this with me, and I'll kind of give you the experience of what he did. We're in a comparative anatomy evolution course, and the doctor opened the book, and he started reading. And I don't remember exactly what he read, but I remember he read it for about a minute and a half. And in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If we jump forward to verse 20, then God said, let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly across the earth, above the earth, across the face of the firmament of the heavens. So God created. And we see the biblical version here, and we compare that to what we just saw on Beyond Today. And where do we go when we want truth? How did this happen? Did it evolve? Did it come up out of the dirt by itself? So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves, with which the waters abounded according to their kind. They were all created according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. God created, and God saw that it was good. And in verse 25, and God made the beasts of the earth according to its kind. They didn't slowly develop out of common predecessors. God made each according to its kind. Cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man. Let us make. We will make. He didn't evolve out of these other animals. Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over the cattle and over the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And we know this is true. This is how we are today. Humans do pretty much what they want with all the other species. So God created man in his own image, verse 27. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And then I won't say his name again, it doesn't matter, he's passed away long since, but he closed that Bible, and he picked it up slowly and reached behind him and set it on his desk, and he looked at all of us, and he said, I wanted you to hear both sides of the story. From here on out, you're getting the other side. And that was evolution. You know, it strikes me by preparing a message like this and by personal experience, many who claim to believe in God and to be Christians believe in evolution. Have you seen that? I know my Catholic friends, that's what they believe in spite of what we just read. I was on a site called talkorigins.org, and they ask a question on this site, doesn't evolution contradict Christianity? And I think, of course it does. How could you say that it doesn't? Their answer was, not always. Certainly, it contradicts a literal interpretation of the first chapter of Genesis. Are we allowed to do that? It always made me nervous when people would toss out one part of the Bible and say, you don't have to pay attention to that, because if you do that, you can toss out any part. Isn't this a contradiction of 1 Timothy 3:16, which we all know? All Scripture is given by inspiration of God. It's inspired. It's God-breathed. We know what that means. Is profitable for doctrine and reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness. All Scripture except for the first few chapters of Genesis, which is what we would be told here. No, we can't do that. Continuing with information from this site, Peter Stravinskas, editor of the 1991 Catholic Encyclopedia, and this is a major work. If you've ever gotten into the Catholic Encyclopedia, there's a lot there. There's actually a lot of useful information. It's a major work. So this individual's editor said, Augustine tells us that we should not interpret Genesis literally. Okay, so who's Augustine? I don't know. Some of you probably do. And that it is poetic and theological language, or I didn't know when I read that. The Catholic theologian Augustine lived in A.D. 354 to 430 and is often recognized as the greatest thinker of Christian antiquity. This is the view of the Catholic Encyclopedia. So that's who he was, an early Catholic individual. Has Catholic teaching changed? TalkOrigins.com asks. And then they go to a site called Does the New Pope Believe in Evolution? Or they show the site and they expound on the answer of that. And I've seen some of this too from the new Pope, an interesting individual in many ways. The answer is actually yes. And in fact, the Roman Catholic Church has recognized Darwinian evolution for the past 60 years. It openly rejects intelligent design and young earth creationism, saying that these things pretend to be science. And that's kind of scary to me. And it brings me back to that letter, creationists. That's us pretending to be or posing as rationalists. And we like to think we are rational people. Back in 1950, Pope Pius XII laid out his papal encyclical, Humani Generis, in other words, the generation of humans, in which the Church's official position on natural selection was laid out. The statement said that there is no intrinsic conflict between Christianity and evolution. Is this our point of view? I hope not. It shouldn't be. The theory, continuing, articulated by Charles Darwin on the origin of the species, has withstood scientific scrutiny since its publication in 1859. Is that a true statement? Has withstood, and the Church does not dispute this. But, and this is one big but, Catholics can believe in evolution just as long as God's involvement is acknowledged. Acknowledged. So that's an interesting statement, too, and they make a comment along those lines. Just what this involvement actually entails has never been made entirely clear. But the problem goes back to, if we believe in evolution, we really don't need God. I mean, the idea is it happened out of the ground by itself. If the Catholic Church perspective then can be held, it is that, well, God orchestrated it. He made it happen. So they say you have to believe it that way. And the Church is adamant on one point, this part of this. The human soul is a creation of God and not the product of natural forces. On this point, the Church will never waver. And it struck me as I was watching the Beyond Today that they held up the booklet twice. Gary Petty did as he talked. And both of those pages showed immortality of the soul. Is this a true doctrine? And so that's what's being said here. The human soul, and we know the human soul is no different from that of an animal. Biblically speaking, the breath, the life, is the creation of God and not a product of evolution. On this point, the Church will never waver. Another recent message by a pope on evolution. October 1996, Pope John Paul II issued a message to the Pontifical Academy of Science reaffirming the Roman Catholic Church's long-standing position on evolution, that it does not necessarily conflict with Christianity. So I thought it was interesting. I kind of knew it, but not to that extent, I suppose. Beyond Genesis, what does God's Word, what else does God's Word say about creation and where we came from? Look in Matthew 19. These are the words of Christ. Matthew 19, and he was talking to Pharisees here, but he makes a statement about humans and where they came from. Matthew 19 and verse 4. And he answered then and said to them, have you not read that he who made them, this is where they came from, at the beginning made them male and female. And he goes on then to define marriage and that humans were made male and female and so forth. And of course, that's a different subject there. And I won't go there, but Mark 13:19 describes in the beginning of the creation, which God created. And continually we find the language, God made them. TalkOrigins.org went on to a second question. Isn't evolution a religion? That's what they're asking, and basically it is. It's the religion of the God of this world, the lowercase god of Satan. And it's a very important one because, again, it makes the need for God non-existent. But their answer to this question, isn't evolution a religion? Evolution is based on the scientific method. There are tests that can determine whether or not the theory is correct as it stands. And these tests can be made. Thousands of such tests have been made. And I'm quoting directly now from the internet source. Thousands of such tests have been made, and the current theories have passed them all. That's evolution. And what I just read to you is patently false. And yet this is what people believe. hook, line, and sinker, this is what people believe, that this is a good and strong theory. That is not the case. Also, scientists are willing to alter the theories as soon as new evidence is discovered. This allows the theories to become more and more accurate as research progresses. And so that's what we can read. And my title today is the same as our booklet on this source. And Jordan, maybe you can pop up that first slide, shows our booklet. And this is an excellent resource, and I've pulled a good bit from this, Creation or Evolution. Creation or Evolution. And I mentioned there's a general feeling that all scientists accept the theory of evolution. Let's go to the second slide. The doctor who said, I wanted you to hear the other side. And so today, let's look at the other side. That's one slide back, but we're going to be there, so that's fine. Hang on to, who do we have here? Louis Pasteur. So I asked the question about this general feeling of the public, all scientists accept the theory of evolution and don't believe in a creator. Is that correct? Has that historically been correct? Are there scientists of high repute who believe otherwise? And this slide shows Louis Pasteur and his lifetime there where he lived. He's the creator of the smallpox vaccine and has many other things to his name, but that's what he was most famous for doing, saved a tremendous number of lives by what he did. And Pasteur said, the more I study, the more I stand amazed at the work of the creator. And the second quote, do I have it on the slide? Yeah, I do. To me, is an important one. A bit of science distances one from God. And this is so true. What he's saying here is that if you know a little bit, and that's what I find people know about evolution, they know a little bit. They really don't know much at all. They know a little bit, but they're hook, line, and sinker behind it, totally behind it. They know very little about it. A bit of science, a little bit of science distances one from God, but much science nears one to him. Next slide is Wernher von Braun. And this, again, is an individual of exceptionally high repute. He's the former NASA director. He's called the father of the American space program. He was asked at one time by the California State Board of Education for his thoughts on the origin of the universe. And he said, certainly there are those who argue that the universe evolved out of a random process. But what random process could produce the brain of a man or the human eye? And the more we learn, the more phenomenal that question is. How could that possibly happen? I remember back in college taking microbiology. I had an individual interested in evolution. And he took about a week and a half to teach us. And he started the class with, we're going to start with a cell because, frankly, we have no idea where that first cell came from. That was 30 years ago. The problems have not gotten better since, but much worse, as we've learned about the complexities inside these cells. So Dr. von Braun said, there are those who would argue that it happened out of random processes, and that's the premise of evolution. But what random process could produce the brain of a human? And the neurochemical complexity that we find in there and the design function. Some people challenge science to prove the existence of God. And he said, must we really light a candle to see the sun, to see God, to see the sun? Good question. Next slide, Sir Ernst Chain. I'm getting closer to present time. This, again, is a very sharp person. Dr. Chain in 1945 was the Nobel Prize winner for isolating and purifying penicillin. He was the director of Rome's International Research Center for Chemical Microbiology. He was a professor of biochemistry at Imperial College in London. And his quote was, atheists all over the world have called upon science as their crown witness against the existence of God. But as they try with arrogant abuse of scientific reasoning to render proof there is no God, the simple and enlightening truth is that their arguments boomerang. For one of the most fundamental laws of natural science is that nothing in the physical world happens without a cause. It made me think about, maybe you saw in the news, those two scout leaders that pushed that boulder formation over, was that in Utah, in that national park, and they weren't allowed to do that. They shouldn't have touched it. It was supposed to have been there for millions of years, and of course they justify what they did, but nothing happens without a cause. That boulder couldn't just decide, I'm going to jump off of this thing and do it itself. Those guys had to push it off. or enough wind could come by to erode the sand base under it, limestone or water, but there is a cause. And that's what he's saying. There's a cause for things. There simply cannot be a creation without some kind of spiritual creator. In the world around us, we can behold obvious manifestations of the divine plan of the Creator. And I think Dr. Chang was quoting Romans. Look with me in Romans 1 and verse 20. It sounded to me like he was quoting this. There has to be a Creator. We should be able to see that. Romans 1 and verse 20. Someone went and took Romans out of this Bible. Well, there it is. Okay, Romans 1:20. And so this is what Dr. Chang was just saying. For since the creation of the world, his, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even by his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. I wish I had time to go into some of the things we see in biology. And I look at, and you just ask the question, how could anyone ask for something like that to evolve? And God's creation, God being behind this, I think can be clearly seen. Next slide, Francis Collins. And you can see behind him the Human Genome Project. This is a very bright individual. This is not a slow guy. Director of the National Human Genome Research Institute. He's both a medical doctor and a leading gene scientist who was part of the team that discovered the genes for cystic fibrosis and Huntington's disease. What I just said is a remarkably complex thing to do. These guys effectively have learned how to read molecules, and he can look at DNA and home in on the right part and find it and say, here it is. And this person with disease, look, there's one part that's not quite right, and that's not an easy thing to do, being able to do that. So his research, that was something he discovered. Dr. Collins said, I do not believe that there are any collisions between what I believe as a Christian and what I know and have learned as a scientist. He's still alive. Are there other scientists still alive today who are of very high stature and have difficulty with the theory of evolution? My son Jeremy came home from high school once, and he's in the church. He doesn't believe in evolution, but he said, Dad, they sure make you feel ignorant if you say I'm a creationist. Creationist posing as rationalist. And I said, well, Jeremy, here's something you might do, and do this gently, but show your teacher this webpage, and the next slide shows that one, Jordan. It's called the 100 Scientists webpage, and there is an article about this. 100 Scientists Challenge Darwinism was the name of the article. These 100 scientists include some of the top biologists, physicists, chemists, mathematicians, anthropologists, and others, and they were employed at internationally recognized research institutes. And you can see the quote here, I am skeptical of claims for the ability of random mutation. This is what evolution does. It's random events and natural selection to account for the complexity of life. Careful examination of the evidence for Darwinian theory should be encouraged. They're saying we're skeptical about this. So my suggestion to my son was just ask your teacher gently, have you seen the 100 Scientists webpage? These are really bright people, and this is what they do for a living, and they're seeing that it doesn't work. And I just listed some of them. I didn't list all 100. This first person, professor of cellular molecular physiology at Yale University, emeritus professor of chemistry in a NAS, that's National Academy of Science. This is an individual whose lifetime achievements were so great, he was elevated to an exceptionally exclusive club, the National Academy of Science. A professor of mathematical physics. It kind of gives me a chill just to read that one. Mathematical physics, Tulane. Plasma physics lab, Princeton. Professor of biological science, Lehigh University. That's Dr. Michael Behe, and he's a rather well-known individual himself in the evolution arena. He was quite sold on evolution until someone asked him to explain how it happened. And then he said, I thought it was out there, but it's not. So I've heard him speak. Interesting guy. I just put that last guy on because he's from the University of Georgia. I thought I'd have to sell the home school there. There were six on there from Kennesaw, but I left them off. There's Dr. Ross. Not really. Okay, so that's a gentle way if you're facing something in school or elsewhere with colleagues. Say, go look at this page. And there are a lot of people out there who we perceive as rational. Well, let's continue. Next slide, I think, says there are problems with the theory of evolution. I'd like to look at those briefly and consider it from our platform as believing in the Bible and God's truth. You know, one thing for sure, though, the fossil record does back up evolution, right? I mean, we all know that. We've all been taught that. I see some heads going the other way. And remember what I read about. This is the theory that has withstood every challenge, which you can read. Well, let's continue to the next slide. Okay, that's it. The problem number one I've put is the fossil record. And this individual here, this writer, Richard Milton, said the missing link gaps are enormous in the fossil record. From whelks to whales, a whelk is a type of sea snail, class of sea snails. From bacteria to Bactrian camels, there are two species of camels. That's the rare of the two. So he's saying the fossil record, which is the most touted support of the theory of evolution, isn't it? That's what I was taught. That's what we're all taught, is full of holes. And so what I'm going to read now is from our booklet, the church booklet. And speaking as a scientist, which is what I've done the last 30 years, that's a good booklet. We had a predecessor out there that I thought was a little weak in places. This new one is a good booklet for a layperson and scientists alike. Fossils missing in crucial places. Francis Hitching, member of the Prehistoric Society and Society for Physical Research, now sees problems in using the fossil record to support Darwinism. And he says there are about 250,000 different species of fossil plants and animals in the world's museums. This compares with about 1.5 million species known to be alive on Earth today. Given the rates of evolutionary turnover, in other words, how quickly animals go extinct, and we do see things go extinct with now and then, it has been estimated that at least 100 times more fossil species have lived than have been discovered. But the curious thing is there is a consistency about fossil gaps. The fossils go missing in all the important places. When you look for links between major groups of animals, they simply aren't there. Okay, this is a truism. This is a reality. This has led evolutionists to change their platform in kind of questionable ways. They simply aren't there. At least not in enough numbers to put their status beyond doubt. Either they don't exist at all, or they are so rare that endless argument goes on about whether a particular fossil is or isn't or might be a transitional between this group and that. There ought to be cabinets full of intermediates. Indeed, one would expect the fossils to blend so gently, and this was Darwin's premise. He said, this is what we need to find. This is what we will find. Time will prove my theory. Indeed, one would expect the fossils to blend so gently into one another that it would be difficult to tell where the invertebrates ended, animals without a backbone, you know, like a clam or something, and where the vertebrates began, animals with a backbone, like a cat or a lizard or us. But this isn't the case. So that's been a big problem with this fossil record that is so touted. Also acknowledging that the fossil record contradicts rather than supports Darwinism, Professor Eldridge and Goode, Dr. Goode was a Harvard paleontologist and evolutionary biologist. Dr. Eldridge was a paleontologist at the American Museum of Natural History, so two top evolutionists. They propose a radically different theory they call punctuated equilibrium. I always tell my students, never use one small word when you can use two big ones. It adds a little punch somehow. They call punctuated equilibrium, maintaining that bursts of evolution occurred in small, isolated populations that then became dominant and show no change over millions and millions of years. This, they say, is the only way to explain the lack of evidence for evolution in the fossil record. So they're basically saying that evolution didn't happen. And over here on the side, poof, it really happened big time, and these guys came in as the major species. And then they went on for millions and millions of years with no change, and poof, we had another punctuated equilibrium, a burst of activity. Newsweek commented on that, on an article regarding Goode and Niles Eldridge. In the paper they wrote, which was intended at the time merely to resolve a professional embarrassment for paleontologists, their inability to find the fossils of transitional forms of species, the so-called missing links. I've really kind of heard about this all my life. Darwin and most of those who followed him believed that the work of evolution was slow, gradual, and continuous, and that a complete lineage of ancestors, shading imperceptibly one into the next, could be reconstructed for all living animals. This is what he felt we'd find. We haven't felt anything near this. But a century of digging since then has only made their absence more glaring. Okay, so for the fossil record, next slide. Jordan, I think I've pulled pieces together and I listed things that traditional evolution would like us to have, things we need. Simple life forms gradually appearing with similar predecessors, gradually changing over time to more complex forms, countless transitional links between kinds of creatures, beginning and partially completed fossils such as new limbs, bones, and organs, these things that have to be in between what we see that exist. The next slide shows what the Bible would predict. Complex life forms suddenly appearing with no evolutionary predecessors. Complex life forms multiplying after their kinds with limited variety within those kinds. No transitional links between different kinds of creatures. No partial features such as new limbs, bones, and organs. That's what's in the fossil record. So if we ask in the next slide shows, what is the fossil record? What do we find? And you'll see it's exactly what the Bible predicts. This is what we find. Complex life forms suddenly appearing, etc. So that's a huge problem for evolution. The fossil record does not support what we see, and evolutionists are continually trying to adjust it until we come up with punctuated equilibrium that makes it's a theory that's impossible to discount, but it covers for the lack of a fossil record is the way Newsweek described that. So Darwin was confident these fossil discoveries would provide clear and convincing evidence of countless transitional forms that must have existed for his theory to be correct, and that never happened. Okay, number two, problem number two for the evolutionists. This is where I usually go when I face someone on campus that wants to talk about evolution. I call it the molecular impossibility. And others certainly go this way, and you can find books about this, and I've tried to summarize it in a way what we all kind of have a handle on the lottery. And I've never done this, but I saw one of the Mega Million Dollars. Got my pointer up here. Is that? Oh, it's kind of dead on me. Yeah, these numbers I just pulled out of the newspaper or somewhere. And I thought it looks like maybe 60 or something as big as it goes, but I don't know. And then I pulled this thing up, and here's a 60 down here. And I didn't see any number bigger than 60, so I suppose that was it. I put a picture of this mansion here because that's why we want to win the lottery to have something like that. And if it goes, if you're picking a number from 1 to 60, the idea is the same, the concept either way. You've got one chance out of 60 of getting that first number right, number 12, right? That makes sense. And then the 51, you've got one chance out of 60 of getting that right, and so forth for the other numbers. So probability will tell us, and the next slide shows that if we multiply these, for that there's one chance out of 60 times itself five times. And that's about one chance out of 77.7 million of getting the big hit. And when you read the small print on the lottery tickets, that's what it says, isn't it? Something kind of like that, that the odds are pretty small of getting the right numbers. And that's why, that's how the system works. So now let's compare this to evolution. Jordan, next slide. And here's where we'll go back and see what we're asked to believe. We have an Earth with no life on it, and it's just dirt and mud, rocks, and there's a puddle on it, and we have water, and that's okay. And then we can throw into this puddle things that should be there. And Jordan, next one shows atoms in there. There's carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen. That's fine. These would be there, no problem. That's okay. And then next slide shows these starting to combine, and the carbon can pick up two oxygens. I don't mean this sound like a lecture. It's just kind of way cool stuff. And then you get carbon dioxide, and that's what we exhale. And so no one would have any problem with that. And we've got carbon dioxide on Mars. And it's frozen, and the wind blows it and makes some of those little gullies that you see. And next slide shows some more simple molecules. NH3 is ammonia. CH4 is methane. And yeah, these are present on other planets. We know that they are. That's not a problem. And then several years back, some researchers created a system like this in the lab and passed electricity through it. And here the next slide kind of shows that. There's the electricity with lightning. And they got some bigger molecules. Not real big, but bigger. And they got a huge variety of things. Would be expected. But one looked like that molecule. That molecule is called glycine. And it's a piece of a protein. So they said, lo and behold, this is where the pieces of proteins came from. It's a building block of a protein. Proteins are remarkable things. These are little machines that do things in cells. They carry other molecules where they need to be. They act as ion channels on the membrane. They catalyze all kinds of reactions. They build molecules. They are nothing short of little machines. They're like a car engine. They have design written all over them. And here we have a building block of a protein, this glycine molecule. Next slide shows another building block of a protein. This one's a little more complex, and the researchers were never able to get one like this with their electricity through water that has all the components. And life is consisting of 20 of these amino acids, the building blocks of proteins, and they were only able to get a few. But if we give evolution every benefit we possibly can, next slide shows these two amino acids or building blocks, and I'm just going to call them 1 and 2 out of 20. And the next slide then goes back to that pool of water, and there they are, all in there. Let's just say you can have them all. We'll put them all in there and then pass electricity through this as an energy source. Next slide should have a lightning bolt. I'll be shocked if it doesn't. Okay. And some of these will combine with each other. Okay, that's all still fine. There's nothing wrong with this if we give them all of these basic building block proteins. And then let's ask a question. Next slide. Suppose life requires these 10 building blocks in that sequence. And scientists know now what life requires. We have a good handle on the molecules of life and what they look like. And I'm just asking the question, suppose we have to have that for something to live. What are the odds that that would come out of that puddle if we put in all the right building blocks and start? Well, the next slide shows that there are 20 different ones. So for number 17 to be the first one chosen, there's one chance out of 20 that this molecule would start with that. And so forth as we continue. And then the odds of building this molecule that we have to have are shown on the next slide. Multiplying that out, we have one chance out of 100,000 million, billion, 10 trillion, of about 10 trillion. And so that's still okay. I can live with that because the Earth is a big place and there's a lot of puddles. And lightning striking, and you know, this is unlikely, but it might happen in a big universe. And so this is the lottery analogy. But now let's continue it to a protein. The next slide shows a model of a protein. And proteins are amazing things because each of these building blocks are charged, which means they've got little magnets on them. So when you put two of them together, the magnets try to bend away from each other, and that causes the whole protein to form into a three-dimensional shape. And this is the three-dimensional shape of a protein called DNA helicase. It's a protein that builds DNA. And it's a remarkably complex thing. It contains 660 of these building blocks that have to come out of that pond, and this is required for life to work. We have to be able to replicate DNA. So if we ask the question, with random assembly, what's the odds that something like this would correctly assemble? And it has to, because even with one mistake, the three-dimensional shape won't be right, and it won't work correctly or at all. And the answer is, by the same algorithm we've been using, the chances are about 1 in 10 to the 125th power. So how big a number is that? We might consider how many atoms are in the human body. It's a heck of a lot. Sorry, I shouldn't have said it that way. It's a lot. How many atoms are in the Earth? It's a lot. how many atoms are in the universe if we estimate, and the next slide shows that estimate, and I know that's kind of small, the odds of building that protein randomly, if we have to have it out of a system that gives an evolutionist everything they want, and getting it built correctly is one chance out of 10 in the 125th power. The number of atoms in the universe is estimated to be 9.4 times 10 to the 79th power, a number that is so much smaller it's hard to get a handle on it. 10 to the 79th, if we go to the 10 to the 80th, that's 10 times more. 10 to the 81st, that's 100 times more, and so forth to get to 10 to the 125th power. And with this analogy, then, I'll go to Dr. Stephen Myers, I think is next. So Dr. Meyer is the director for the Center of Science and Culture, the Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington. And he's written a number of books on this subject, but he says, you know what, the probability of constructing even one protein of average size like this randomly, if we ask for this to happen, to be short and functional, becomes so small. And there's where that one chance out of 10 to the 125th comes from. I just explained some of the math behind it, or the probability, as to approach the point at which appeals to chance become absurd, even given the probabilistic resources of our multi-billion-year universe. So what he's saying is that if we just look at the numbers, the universe is neither big enough or old enough that we would expect that to happen one time. And yet the simplest cells have to have more than 100 of these proteins to work. They're the little engines working in our body right now, doing everything that our cells need to have done work. So this has to occur, but probability would tell us that that's just not going to happen randomly, even if we set the system up so it benefits the evolutionist. Okay. So with this, I could go back to Michael Behe, the biochemist I mentioned, who signed on to the 100 Scientists page. He's a professor and former acceptor of evolution. After many years of teaching biochemistry, someone said, well, how did that randomly assemble? And he went to the literature and he said, I was astonished to find there were no published papers, or none to speak of, that even tried to explain how a step-by-step process could produce such complexity. This is covered in an earlier edition of Good News Magazine as well. So this is a serious problem for evolutionists. It's one I haven't found anyone who can answer. But let's continue. So I don't want to let's see. Is there another slide after that? It seems maybe. This shows a protein that has a mistake in one part up here. This thing's not working, so I'll just explain it. You see the number 6. The wrong protein, the wrong building block was grabbed at piece number 6 in building a protein called hemoglobin that carries oxygen in our body. And if that mistake is made, then the disease results called sickle cell anemia. So these things have to be put together correctly or we have problems. And that's just an example of that. Okay, the next slide. And please bear with me. I don't want to give a biochemistry lecture, but I asked the question, how simple is DNA? And there were 20 amino acids, and actually DNA is not that complex. There's only 6 different pieces to it. In the top left, that deoxyribose is simply a sugar. There's a sugar molecule. It's closely related to glucose or sucrose. There's a phosphate, a phosphorus with oxygens. And then there are these 4 things called base pairs, and they're really not all that complex. That's what DNA is made of. And if you go to the next slide, it shows a bit of a DNA ladder on the left there, and the rails on the left and right of that ladder are just alternating sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate. That's all they are. And on the right, it's the same thing, sugar, phosphate, up that rail, and in the middle, you see those base pairs. You know, those are remarkable molecules the way they're designed. I guess I shouldn't have used that word, the way they evolved. I'm sorry. Those little green molecules in there, if you put your fingers together and pretend there's a magnet on the end of each one, then they'll kind of stick together. But you can pull them apart if you want, and then pop, 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 snap them back together. That's the way this molecule works. With those green base pairs in the middle, and you see little lines going back and forth, those are the electronic magnetic attractions. Inside this molecule, if I could make my arms microscopic and reach out and grab those 2 rails on the left and right of the DNA molecule and open them up, they would open up just like my fingers, pop, pop, pop. They're just little magnets. And then I could boop, boop, put them right back together, back and forth like a zipper. It'd be a good time. So DNA has to be able to do that. It has to be able to open up to replicate, and cells have to replicate their DNA when they divide so that both cells get a copy. So that's a necessity of these molecules. DNA is a huge molecule. How big is it compared to the protein we just looked at, the DNA helicase that makes this molecule? So a typical one-celled organism, bacteria, contain DNA with a molecular weight of, well, before we show that, next slide shows the molecular weight of the protein we looked at that we just saw estimates of the probability of randomly happening, really precludes it happening. That thing has a molecular weight, the protein, of 120,000. That just means it's 120,000 times bigger than a proton. That's all it means. Gives us a reference point. So how much is the molecular weight of DNA in a bacteria compared to 120,000? Is it bigger? Next slide. Yeah, it's 680 billion. And so what we're asked to believe is that this thing, randomly assembled by itself out of the dirt, to give us what we're seeing here. Okay, but the problems get bigger than that. Let's continue on the next slide. So problems we have is that if it did happen, if DNA somehow randomly assembled in a puddle of muddy water with the right constituents in it, what would happen to that molecule? And the answer is nothing would happen to it. It'd just sit there because it can't replicate without proteins. Proteins are required to produce more DNA. They are the little machines that go up and down the DNA and read it and grab the pieces and assemble a new molecule just like it. You can't have more DNA without proteins. Okay, the next slide, another problem. And I showed some of the proteins on that last slide, DNA polymerase, DNA helicase, and other proteins. So you can't make more DNA without proteins, but DNA is required to make the proteins. So basically what I'm saying is you can't have this one without that one, but you can't have that one without this one. And what this means to the evolutionists is that the protein, for no particular reason, had to randomly assemble in the puddle of water by itself, and the DNA, for no particular reason, had to randomly assemble in the water by itself, and then these two accidentally assembled so perfectly that they worked together. And it's worse than that. We need to put a cell around them and have an inside and an outside and protect them. So next slide shows we're kind of in a chicken and egg situation. Which came first, the protein or the DNA? Well, you know, that's really an easy question. That chicken came first because someone had laid that egg. But wait a second, where did chickens come from? Maybe, I guess the egg came first because that chicken hatched out of something. And you see where we go. And the problem with proteins and DNA is that neither one of them came first. They couldn't. They had to come at the same time. If you believe in creation, then it's not a problem at all. But that's what we see. So this is a huge problem for the evolutionists. Let's continue on, though, because it gets hugely worse. And this is the last problem. It's called by Dr. Meyer the signature of the cell. And the idea here is that, believe it or not, there's a language inside that molecule. When we start looking, and it was in the 50s when Watson and Crick decoded DNA and figured out what the structure was, this double helix with these base pairs. And then people started realizing, hey, if we look at the order of those base pairs, it's telling us something. It's saying something. And I circled three here. GTC, these are glutamine, thiamine, and cysteine. And every three in a sequence forms a word in the DNA, and we've learned to read those words. And that's how the former individual I showed was able to identify the cystic fibrosis gene, because he can read the DNA sufficiently to say, here it is. This produces the problem that we have. So those are words, and the next slide shows some of these words and what they mean, and it's probably going to be a bit small, but will that next slide pop up there, Jordan? And it shows what scientists have figured out. For instance, the series ATG is, and if I can read that, maybe I'll, is, no, T, These glasses work, but not for that far stuff. Cysteine is TGT and so forth. The idea is that as a protein is walking up that DNA, it hits TGT, and it says that means I need a cysteine. So it tells another protein, bring me a cysteine. It brings it in, and it plugs it onto the molecule being built. And then it reads the next one, GGT, I need a glycine, give me a glycine. Another protein carries it in, they plug it on, and these proteins are following a blueprint. That's the language inside the DNA. They do more than that. If you smoke cigarettes for a while, then the reactive molecules in the cigarette put adducts or extra reactive molecules that bind onto the DNA and cause problems because they're covalently binding and you can't get rid of them. And proteins go up that DNA and they say, whoops, here's something that's not right. Let's go ahead and cut these three base pairs out. Okay, now bring me a methionine, bring me a histine, bring me a tryptophan. We'll rebuild that. And they put it back together. They're little machines. They're like a car engine. You have a wrong assembly on one, it's like a car engine with all the pistons going this way, except for one going this way, and it doesn't work. It's high fidelity. It has to be done correctly. So the next slide. If DNA developed randomly, then we would ask the question, how could it contain a language? How could it contain an information? So I just went to my keyboard, and I just started hitting letters. You know, random hitting. And that's what I came up in the second line there, the middle one. Jordan, would you read that for me, please? Yeah, well, it doesn't say anything. And with random development, that's what you get. That's what you would expect for a molecule that randomly developed out of the ground by itself with nothing pushing it. And in the third line, I typed something myself. The English language was developed from letters using a thought process. That's how languages happen. With a thought process. The evidence of design, I think, is irrefutable. That's the point of Stephen Meyer's book, The Signature in the Cell. Here it is. There's a language in this cell. Was, we define that means past tense, developed. It was created, it was produced from letters, the building blocks using a thought process. There was a mind that did this thing. There was a mind. Where was that mind? Was it random processes? Random processes don't do that. Next slide is a quote from an information person, Professor Werner Gitt, information systems expert, director, German Federal Physics and Technology Institute. And Dr. Gitt says there is no known process and no known sequence of events that can cause a language, information, to originate by itself in matter. You know, we have the sequence of all these base pairs now, these green things. We have decoded the DNA. We have the total sequence of human DNA now, and we know what little pieces of it read, but most of it we don't. It's a very long book reading all this sequence. And so major institutions have established what we call bioinformatics centers. And very bright people are brought in, and their whole point is, let's read this book. This book inside the DNA, what's this telling us? Let's read it. I talked with one at Virginia Tech. When I was there, we spent $80 million to set up our Bioinformatics Institute at Virginia Tech, and one individual said, it is absolutely impossible. Wasn't a religious man at all, that this came out of the ground by itself under random processes. Do you know what that means? He told me. It means an alien came to this planet in the past and charged it with life. He said, it's unavoidable. It had to be. You know what? He was right. The alien's name was God. Maybe I shouldn't call God an alien, but yeah, it has to be. And so very bright people are coming to that conclusion. Okay, the next slide talks a little bit about how much information can be stored in DNA, and we all carry around our thumb drives and our little information devices with our computer, and we want to store more and more. So Michael Denton, a microbiologist, calculated one teaspoon is enough to contain all the information required to build all the proteins for all the species of organisms that have ever lived on the earth, plus a little extra. Next slide, Jordan. With enough room left over for all the information in every book humans have ever written, this is a remarkable information storage system. And, you know, computer people want to be able to store more information in smaller spaces. This is a way to do it, and you've probably heard about attempts to use molecular storage. We're certainly not there yet, but people like Bill Gates are interested. I think next slide shows a Bill Gates quote. And he, of course, is a very bright person. DNA is like a software program, but much more complex than anything humans have ever devised. And it came out of the dirt by itself, randomly, with nothing behind it. Next slide. And so unanswered problems for evolution. It is not supported by the fossil record. Don't believe it when people tell you that it is. It's not. This punctuated equilibrium is a foolish theory to get evolutionists out of the predicament they're in, that Darwinian evolution cannot be supported by the fossil record. The odds against this happening randomly are astronomical, to the point that we could not accept that it happened. For one protein, much less DNA and proteins that work together. And the third point, there's a language in that molecule that could only arise through design and a thought process. And that's a pretty cool book. I've put on this sign, The Signature of the Cell, by Dr. Steve Meyer. Next slide. And this kind of reflects what the bioinformatics individual said to me. This individual, Dr. Anthony Flew, was a very strong atheist for quite a while. And he eventually, looking at what we've just been through, said he changed his point. An intelligent source of some kind had to be involved in the production of DNA. If you have eyes to see and ears to hear, it's there. I don't think we can avoid it. As the Bible says, it's reflected in God's creation. And the more we learn, the more the problems get for the evolutionary theory. And so that might be my last slide. I'm not sure, Jordan. Did I finish with that guy? Oh, I forgot. I put humans in here. So what you're asked to believe is that that dirt somehow produced those humans by itself, with their minds and their eyes, with a mind that has the spirit within man that God places there, with a mind capable of housing the Holy Spirit. And it's an awful lot to be asked to believe. In that regard, Psalm 14:1 says, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." So evolution is very confusing to a lot of people, and it's a powerful tool of Satan, and there will be others like that. But if we always turn back to the Bible as our basic guide, God made them. That's the one that makes the most sense. It takes more faith to believe in evolution than creation, by far.